KZSU, Stanford University. Welcome to another edition of Hearsay Culture. My name is Dave Levine. I am a resident fellow at the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford Law School. When I'm actually recording the show, which is in late May, by the time you hear this show on KZSU, I will be a non-resident fellow at the Center for Internet and Society and an assistant professor at the New Law School in Charlotte, North Carolina, the Charlotte School of Law. So you're hearing this show recorded in late May, but I guarantee you we will keep it timely in our discussion. Today I'm very excited to have on a fellow of sorts, a non-resident fellow at the Center for Internet Society named Bruce Cahan. And Bruce is a guest who is focusing in an area that I can say we have not discussed on Hearsay Culture. We've touched on it, but very, very sparsely. And the issue and the topic we're going to discuss today is spatial technology. Spatial technology, which I will allow Bruce to define because he knows far more about than I do. I'm a bit of a neophyte in this area. It's probably one of the areas that I least know about of all the people I've interviewed on the show. So I'm going to be learning a lot myself in this discussion. But spatial technology in the broadest sense involves the use of mapping and other kinds of technology to figure out basically what's around us. Now, I've just made it so incredibly simple. I don't see Bruce shaking his head in disgust, so I'm assuming it wasn't entirely off. But we'll let Bruce discuss it in more detail. But what we're talking about here are things like Google Maps. I mean, I think Google Maps has put the issues of spatial technology kind of front and center. The idea that you can go to Google, type in an address, and scroll down to the point that you can see cars and driveways in a particular location is something that I think kind of shocks people and also is a bit awe-inspiring. I've fooled around on Google Maps and checked out Pyongyang, figuring I'm never going to see North Korea otherwise. And it's fascinating to see the landscape. And it's in some ways, it's really scary to see the landscape as well, and that's part of what the spatial technology is about. Bruce is also, among other things, an interesting person because he is a lawyer who has entered into the world of spatial technology really as a result of some kind of shocking experiences that you had in New York, and we're going to talk about how Bruce came to going from a lawyer to someone heavily involved in the world of spatial technology. So I'm very excited to have Bruce Cahan on today on Hearsay Culture. You're going to be listening to music today, for those of you listening live on KZSU, by George Montalva, a CD entitled Pipe Organ Favorites and Fantasy in Pipe Organ and Percussion. So the music selection today is going to be also quite different. So this is going to be an unusual show, and I'm looking forward to it. So we're going to take a short music break, and when we return on KZSU's Hearsay Culture, we'll start the discussion with Bruce Cahan. On the other side of the glass, showing up live, although this is a recorded show, being here in studio is Bruce Cahan. Bruce, thank you for joining me on Hearsay Culture.
David, this is great.
Well, thanks. It's and like I said, the music selection today is really kind of different for us, and it also gets us right into this topic, which, as I mentioned in the introduction, is a new one to me. But first, before we even get to spatial technology, it would be useful to simply define it in a much better way than I did and talk to the listeners a little about who you are and how you got into this field.
Well, actually, your definition was perfect.
It great.
Fine. I think Google Earth and Google Maps lets us have a metaphor that we can all relate to now. But imagine in the early 1990s, before Google Earth, gave us the hands-on experience we have of clicking on a spot on the face of the Earth and zooming right there and seeing all this fantastic data from multiple sources. Spatial technologies have been around in the military and the corporate and the government realms for a couple of decades, and they required huge computing power to process the spatial relationships, the place-based relationships. Those of us in this area say everything happens somewhere, and we emphasize the where when we say it. 80% of all information that governments and companies use has a spatial identifier, so that knowing your street address is how we're able to send you all that junk mail. Knowing that you own a piece of property is how we know your income level, et cetera, et cetera. So spatial has been a part of running communities in a soft way and in somewhat a controlled way for generations. But now, with the Internet, we have this fantastic capacity to use place as a vehicle for transparency, to see through many levels of control and administration and ownership of data or purpose for which data was owned, and get really at the roots of why is this place, whether it's Stanford or New York City, behaving the way it is. Another part of this is if you think of the word infrastructure, which mm-hmm. is an overused term, infrastructure is sort of the legacy left over from thousands of decisions by prior generations. Imagine if they knew the places impacted mm-hmm. by those decisions as well as we can do today.
The issues of spatial technology are ones that I think, as, you know, using Google Maps as the paradigm that we can relate to. But I don't think people stumble into this area much as the way in the way that you did. And you have an interesting story about how you came to be interested in this stuff. And I think the listeners would find it interesting. I certainly did.
It's true, David. Sometimes opportunity knocks with a huge explosion. And in my case, in 1989, August of 89, to be specific, Con Edison, which is the steam and electric and gas utility in New York City, was repressurizing a 135-year-old pipe, and it was wrapped in 220 pounds of asbestos, and it exploded. And it exploded at the door front of my apartment building at the time, killed three people, and we were nomads. I was literally a nomad. My stuff had to be thrown out, all the friable, all the clothing, all the anything that could that asbestos could have clinged to. And up until that point, I had basically been a real estate and corporate and municipal finance lawyer, and I had done public development deals for the state of New York. I had worked on the sale of the GM building and other public development projects, and the notion that city streets could explode was anathema to me. I couldn't imagine that happening.
Right, right. That's the kind of thing you generally think about in movies or in video games.
Yeah, and the one of the reasons that occurred, that explosion occurred, was that a water crew for the city was working two blocks away at 18th and Irving, for those New Yorkers on the line.
Right.
And this happened at 20th and 3rd. And the water from the 18th and Irving workspace flowed under the streets around this repressurizing pipe.
Huh.
So not knowing the spatial proximity of any listener can understand, 18th Street versus 20th Street is two blocks away. So not knowing that you were in such close proximity meant the two work crews didn't and couldn't coordinate.
And we're talking about something that happened less than 20 years ago.
Correct. Correct. And at the time, the city, I think it'd be fair to say, even though I have friends in the city, and I expect to have friends after this interview in the city, was not prepared for subsurface asbestos abatement, did not really understand that it existed, nor what would happen when aerating that in a geyser of steam that lasted many, many hours across a park space, how you would remediate that? How would you deal with that?
And this was something that occurred partially, or how much would you say it occurred as a result of a lack of information? Was it, I mean, are we talking about geospatial mapping as being the solution to problems like this in your view? How did, in seeing this problem, how did you draw the connection to the work that we're going to discuss in a moment?
I saw that a map, a single map, a unifying map, as opposed to each authority or each agency of the city and its utilities and its real estate developers and its title companies having separate maps that didn't align, I saw that a single unifying map would be very, very helpful.
Now, we're talking about, in the particular instance, we're talking about subterranean mapping. And I know that this is anecdata in the purest form, but the legend from having moved from New York just a few years ago is that New York has more underground layers than any other city in the world or something along those lines, where you could map out electrical and water and the subway system, et cetera, and so forth. I'm curious to know, in 1989 versus today, How far have we come? In other words, you know, this is classic crystal ball kind of, or even worse, it's Monday morning quarterbacking. But do you think the kind of mapping that you're looking at now is the kind of mapping that, had it existed in 1989, would have prevented the problem, or are we not there yet?
You know, it is nice to be in a time capsule. It's safer. But the truth is that we are not as far along as we could be.
Mm-hmm.
That the politics of data continue to perseverate, notwithstanding the technical interoperability. There is institutional operability that has yet to be worked on. And we can talk about orgware and some work for the federal government that I and many others have done to instigate a true national geospatial data infrastructure. I've testified before Congress and other places, and I brought a 1939 Fortune magazine World's Fair edition to those testimonies. And in there, you see a slice, like a CAT scan, through Radio City Hall, taking you all the way down to bedrock. And yeah, there are lots and lots of layers, perfectly artist illustrated, you know, with different colors. Then there was a magazine called 7 Days that lasted for a while in New York, and it had sort of spaghetti. Nothing so neat, and I'm using my hands to describe what spaghetti of wires and cables and conduits. And this is very real because in New York, you have high and low tension conduit franchises. So the electrical versus the telephone / cable. And when they were trying to get cable into New York City buildings, the cost of connecting a building was a little bit determined by where the access point to that building might be and how would you find it and whether the subsidiary of the telephone company that controlled the knowledge of that location wanted the cable people to find it cheaply.
In the urban environment, and I think it's worth exploring here before we kind of talk. I want to talk about the politics of it and the work you've done on a government level and the private sector activities of Google Maps and others. But I want to get a sense of the urban environment that we're talking about here. I know people are familiar, of course, with New York City. But when you're talking about geospatial mapping, what ultimately are we talking about from a practical perspective? What are its current capabilities, and what are its current limitations?
Well, you've got about 15 years of work on interoperable standards to put the data about a building's location, let's say, in a form that can be recognized by any application that is written to understand those standards.
Mm-hmm.
That has taken a long time because there were vendors who had proprietary software with proprietary data standards. And they've had to work through groups like OpenGIS Consortium and others to create that synonymous characteristic to their data. So instead of multiple data sets at the same place, you could standardize on a common data set, which would be understood by applications, whether it was the transportation department trying to lay out a better route or it was the public health folks trying to look for an epidemic, that no matter whose application was running, they'd still call New York a New York street.
Mm-hmm.
I used to talk about there being at any one point in time on a New York street corner at an intersection, there'd be four separate surveyors, one per corner, surveying the same exact street.
Right.
It didn't change based on who paid the surveyor that day.
Mm-hmm.
It was still the curb line for everybody.
Right, right. And the ability of one doing that kind of work to ascertain what was around them has been augmented by the technology as it exists in the last 10 years?
Google Earth, which is, I know you've been saying Google Maps, but really, I think you really mean Google Earth, which operates with its KML.
Oh, you're right. I was saying Google Earth, correct.
And you know, I took the risk of correcting a host.
No, I know. I appreciate it. You nailed it.
and so the notion that you could have a layer cake of data and have it displayed and discoverable, or discoverable displayed, all of that required lots of clearinghouse and other activity that way preceded Google Earth's arrival on the scene.
Mm-hmm.
But Google Earth obviously can leverage this massive, now increasingly interoperable and internationally interoperable set of data. So no matter what language is resident of the to the place that you're mapping, you can still see the coastline.
Do you think, and you're right to use, I was saying Google Earth, do you think that Google Earth benefits the public in the sense that it opens people's eyes to what the technology can do? Or are there concerns among the spatial imaging community that it gives an unrealistic expectation as to the capabilities of the technology? In other words, is Google Earth a fair representation of where we are and what the public, the people that are not scientists, could do with the technology?
You know, on a mass markets level, so for mass adoption, Google Earth is yet another step, and a big step, in putting in your and my hands on our PCs, on our laptops, on our phones, this tactile experience of what it looks like to live your life knowing where you are.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. There are other markets for geospatial and technologies where Google Earth is not defining the everything that can be done. For instance, I do look forward to seeing much more transparent accountability for government decisions.
Mm-hmm.
Google Earth, you know, doesn't do that today. I'm not saying it couldn't. I hope it does. And, mm-hmm. and you know, they are friends of the endeavor, and I don't speak for the geospatial community. I'm not self-appointed to do that.
But, right.
But as an observer and as a participant, you know, it's really obvious that once Google Earth happened, people got the joke. They got what it would be like. It was the aha moment for a lot of people.
Let's talk about the government and transparency, because I know that's been the prime focus of your work. And perhaps the way to start off that portion of the discussion is to ask you about Urban Logic and the organization that you co-founded.
Sure.
So if you could tell us a little bit about Urban Logic and its genesis and what its goals are and how it leads you in this direction.
Well, after the steam pipe explosion, I had been wondering why the city didn't have its own unifying map. You know, what was so unique? Why was this not already existent? And it turned out in the Lindsay administration, such a thing had been proposed by Professor Savas. But as I talked to folks within New York City, it seemed like an idea that no commissioner really wanted to have happen.
Hmm.
And I had a private company, a for-profit company, and every time I'd try to get noticed and suggest that we could make a public-private partnership out of an idea I called NIMAP, New York Map,
mm-hmm.
I was pushed aside. I formed a nonprofit with a partner, David Coons, and suddenly as a nonprofit we were listened to, and also I could testify before city council, and I could talk about the waste, and I could go to the city's budget office, and ultimately was able to estimate that $537 million would have been spent by the city over a 10-year period on separate mapping applications. And by dint of that number, and also my knowledge as a finance lawyer of how to read the city's bond act, and that I could make data, not hardware, but data, eligible for their capital budgets funding,
mm-hmm.
I unleashed a funding line to do a single unifying map that they call the GIS utility that is housed now in the Department of Information and Technology as NICEMAP, NYC Map. And that was delivered operationally, I would say, 6 months before 9/11 hit.
We're talking, and it's and getting us to 9/11 is important, and I think it's, again, it's useful because it leads me in this direction. We often see, and we saw it in September 11th and clearly the reports, but we see it in any law, in any governmental structure, a lack of communication and coordination between entities. And New York City has an abundance of public corporations and city agencies that work in tandem more or less. When you're talking about a unified map, we don't have to go into an incredible level of detail here, but I'm curious, how does a map like that get created? What are we talking about in terms of the manpower and the technology necessary to create a unified map as you describe it, and especially a map that was created around the beginning of 2001, let's say?
The way you create this kind of a map is typically an airplane will fly at a low altitude with special cameras that are gyro-stabilized and that know their location using GPS and ground-based monumentation. And so they look for little target things on the sidewalk or wherever that are known to have a geoposition. Those tiles of maps are photographs stitched together. And increasingly they're stitched together by computer, not hand. And then the outlines for the curbs of the streets, the footprints of the buildings, even the tree canopies can be recognized automatically by computer now, so that what you see in, let's say, a Hammond Atlas or Rand McNally Atlas or what you're used to seeing in that way can much more be generated on the fly.
Mm-hmm.
And at New York, I think, reflies itself every a third of it or a fifth of it every few years, so that within about 5 years you get an updated map. And in a city like New York, where 1,000 buildings might be altered or added in 2 or 3 years' time,
mm-hmm.
you do have to constantly refly and retarget. The question of, do you do a two-dimensional map, so an XY coordinate, or do you add elevation, a Z coordinate, and how you deal with the fourth dimension. And your music today was fourth dimensional, of time, you know, of wanting to see the same street change over a decade.
Right.
That's all a matter of how accurate you'd like to be. So, for instance, a utility trying to find its 1915 conduit might pull out a strip map, a parchment kind of a map, that showed a gas light as the monument on the sidewalk. You can't find that gas light because it ain't there anymore.
Right. It seems like, and you were talking about the politics of it, and I think it's a good area to explore a little bit. Technology often can bridge political gaps and allow for coordination and cooperation that wouldn't otherwise exist, especially, as you alluded to, when you can figure out an easy way to fund it, an easy way to get it done, and all of the political aspects, which would be a little too far afield for the show. But I'm curious to get your sense of your experience dealing with a large, you know, major city like New York, and the ability and the fact that you have a technology which is still largely unknown to people except in this kind of pop culture way with Google Earth and I was using Google Maps, but the idea of just being able to type in words and get directions and things like that. We're not talking about a level of sophistication in terms of the uses that you're describing in the operations of a city. In your experience, how does spatial technology and the technology generally allow for, or does it allow for, greater coordination? And does it, in fact, am I right to say, it makes it easier in some sense to get that kind of coordination amongst, you know, throughout an enormous bureaucracy?
I think it does. It takes away the agenda-driven data component of our society.
Mm-hmm.
So, and we can talk about my work on sustainable resiliency mm-hmm. and trying to use a composite of performance benchmarks to see how we're doing, in Ed Koch's words. When you look at Congress and funding various priorities, when the transportation groups go up and ask for reauthorization of the highway bill, they show you how the bridges are falling down.
Mm-hmm.
When the environmental groups want to do something, they tell you how there's all kinds of problems with the environment, and there are. When you look at avian flu risk and the public health, people will tell you that. Well, you're managing a portfolio of resiliency in a place, in a region, in our 9-county Bay Area where we are right now.
Mm-hmm.
How do you use data to help self-prioritize all of these worthy endeavors under limited budget constraints? That's what spatial knowledge, spatial transparency helps you do.
When we return from the music break, I want to talk about the sustainable resiliency and transparency. Transparency being an area where I can actually bring more to the table, and because it's an interest of mine from an intellectual property perspective. You're listening to KZSU's Hearsay Culture and Bruce Kahan, a non-resident fellow at the Center for Internet and Society. We're going to return to a little fourth dimensional music, here for a few minutes, and then when we come back, we will continue the discussion on Hearsay Culture. My notes for that song say that is the oddest version of Stars Fell in Alabama that's out there. And I think I'm going to concur with that analysis. You're listening to Hearsay Culture on KZSU. Before we return to the conversation with Bruce Kahan, now's the time where I ask you for money for KZSU. KZSU is a nonprofit, non-commercial radio station at Stanford University that is dedicated to bringing you diverse programming and diverse talk programming and sports and public affairs, and requires donations from listeners to keep its programming on the air. If you're interested in making a donation to Hearsay Culture, I would suggest, or not to Hearsay Culture, actually, if you want to do that, we can discuss that off the radio, but to make a donation to KZSU, you should click on the donate button on kzsu.stanford.edu, KZSU's webpage, or alternatively, you can email our underwriting department at underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. Regardless, please do continue to listen in. You should also know I am not soliciting any donations for Hearsay Culture. These are, in all seriousness, donations I'm soliciting for KZSU itself. So we're back with Bruce Kahan. And Bruce, before the music break, we were talking about transparency. And I think we can start the discussion there and then close the show today by discussing sustainable resiliency. Top level question, how does geospatial imaging potentially allow for transparency, and how effective has it been thus far?
You know, let's keep the analogies to New York because it's where I think we both have hailed from.
Mm-hmm.
In New York, the old paradigm was if you want data, spatial data about the city, you would have to buy a CD that was very expensive from the city planning department called Bites of the Big Apple. And that would have to be used by a kind of proprietary software that you had to know how to import the data into. Now, if you go to nyc.gov, the city's website, you can find the mayor's My Neighborhood statistics.
Hmm.
And if you have a street address or a community borough or whatever, you can get fast readout on how clean is your street, how many crimes are there, what's the education level. All of those statistics are spatially enabled.
How so?
There's an underlying data set that has been keyed to recognize community boards, and the community board identifier of your intersection, your street address, is processed through another application the city has made available for this purpose in the My Neighborhood space.
Huh.
But the real point is that without having geocoded the precinct data from the NYPD, the police records, mm-hmm. without having geocoded the relative freedom from potholes, the all these neighborhood quality of life measures.
Right.
If you didn't geocode them, if you didn't put a place attribute, if you just said the city is 20% cleaner than it is last year, no one would be able to query a data set and say, okay, I understand for the five boroughs it's 20%, but my neighborhood's no cleaner, or my neighborhood is cleaner. Or you can contrast my neighborhood, which might be a wealthy neighborhood, with a poor neighborhood and argue for social equity using the spatial dimension of the statistics. And this is given, I don't want to imply that New York is alone in this. There's a national infrastructure of community statistics that Brookings is putting together. There are many efforts to grow the community statistical space so that local groups can argue for their priorities armed with the statistical knowledge as to the place that they have greatest concern.
Whenever we're talking about transparency, the government becomes a bit at loggerheads. Putting aside the question of whether ultimately elected officials want more or less transparency, a Benthamite-type discussion that we can have at another time, there's a practical reality here, and the practical reality, I think, boils down to whether, in fact, transparency in this sense can ultimately does have a public benefit. And I guess it may be too early to tell, but I'm curious to get your perspective on if there are examples at this point, or if you think, in fact, this technology is at the point where people are using it in that transparent way to keep an eye on the decision-making process, to keep an eye on where money is being spent or where it should be spent. Is there any data on that? Is there research being done? What's your sense?
If you go to opensecrets.org today, you can navigate to an incredible wealth of campaign donor, elected official campaign finance records that are spatially relevant to the town or the state that you care about, that the Federal Election Commission maintains. A pet project that I've wanted to do and tried to find the resources to do would be to align the campaign donor data sets, both federal and state, with the procurement data sets. In other words, how government spends the close to 40% of the GDP. So that you would be able to see, somebody gave a contribution here and they ended up with public contracts there. Isn't that fascinating? And then to use geospatial to ask the question, would those contracts have been better disaggregated regionally? In other words, when the federal government buys buses or it buys whatever it buys, how would growing the local economy have been possible using the same dollars if you knew that the local capacity to make that stuff existed? So instead of sending the procurements the way the campaign finance dollars dictated them, you sent them the way the spatial capacities would reward them, would deserve them.
There's always a concern when it comes to transparency, and towards the end of the show, I think it'd be useful to point out where and how people can get in touch with you to discuss these issues offline. But there's always an issue with transparency, which boils down to, well, you can have all the information that you want out there, but if the public doesn't do anything with it, or the public doesn't react to it, then what good is it doing? Now, it's a cynical view, but more and more you see this view espoused that the public isn't really interested in these things. Now, mapping and technology, I think, is a different sphere. And I'm curious to get your response to that. As I think about these issues, I mean, the thing that jumps out at me, and it's something we were talking about on the way walking over to the station today, is literally the graphical environment in which we find ourselves. Google Earth draws you in that way. What do you make of that critique? Is there something to it, or are we really in an entirely new space?
You know, I'm the son of an accountant, and I've learned to speak OMB speak of necessity. I speak lots of languages. I speak spatial and New York and try to speak Silicon Valley speak. And the point of the language in which we think is that when you can see dollars spatially, you have many more options for using them better. I think of the world as cascades of cash flows to a place.
Mm-hmm.
I see companies that live or their workers reside and their markets depend on a place. I see NGOs and venture philanthropists throwing money into a place, but I don't see them knowing the entirety, the composite, of what it would mean to organize that cash better.
Hmm.
And cash also is out of pocket and intergenerational. So whether it's an externality that some future generation has to pay for, it's still cash. Thinking of the world that way means that transparency is a very alive market concept. It's not, I agree with you, the notion of technical right to get data through a FOIA or e-FOIA kind of request and the pragmatic capacity to actually use and do something and come up with an analysis based on the data, far different things.
Mm-hmm.
And we're seeing a merger of paths where instead of designing systems where public access was the afterthought to building the data system, it's now designed in as an original element because you know whatever you're building as a government official or even increasingly as a corporate matter will go public in some way.
And I think that to me is a key point, what you just said there at the end, because I think back to my time before I went to law school, I was a legislative aide in the New York State Assembly. And this was in 1994, 1995, when the internet was still not, I mean, in that point was growing, and certainly people were aware of it, but it wasn't widely used. One of the projects I worked on was the idea, which has since come to fruition, of what you just described, putting campaign finance information on the internet. And the infrastructural, I agree with you, it's an overused term, although it's something I'd like to write about what we mean by that today. But putting that aside, there was a basic issue at that time, which boiled down to, what are we going to do with this information, assuming we can even get it out there? And, of course, there is a visceral reaction to people watching what you're doing. The geospatial technology we're talking about today has been unleashed. It's there.
Yep.
And I guess it's an interesting thing to follow at this point as to how the technology, when it can be manipulated entirely, 100% by the public, as opposed to being put given to you by the government, which is what we were thinking about doing in the mid-90s,
mm-hmm.
you couldn't manipulate the data, but you'd have easy access to it, is going to mean for us in transparency. It's a fascinating area.
And there are two sides to this. I mean, just talk about the privacy issues unleashed by robust spatial technologies. On the one hand, you want to make cell phone calls without everybody knowing exactly where you are. On the other hand, if you just to stay with a 9/11 analogy or any other disaster, if I knew that there were asthmatic or respiratory cases in Battery Park City, which is southwest of the Trade Towers,
mm-hmm.
I'd want those people evacuated first, and I would want to find them using the geospatial. So. The devil is in the details. The public policy around it is important. You don't want to enable more mass merchandising and direct mail fracas. But at the same time, there are affinity uses for this spatial concern. And you will see over the Internet's progression and whatever you want to call it, the semantic web,
mm-hmm.
folks using spatial to find each other and bring common energies together to a region or a place that they have greatest concern.
In the last about 8 minutes or so that we have, I do want to touch on the project that you're working on now and that we discussed a little bit on the way over. So you talked about sustainable resiliency, and I think, again, in this sphere, we first require a definition. What is it, and what project are you working on right now?
After the command center experience, and I was privileged to work at the command center because of knowing how to get spatial data to help the city with its response. I was wondering what would have been different. You know, how could the city have been better prepared? How could the networks have functioned better? Networks of people, not just computers. And I hit upon the notion that we were trying to maximize two things, sustainability of a city and resiliency or ballast to absorb harm. And that became my two-word mantra in contradistinction to homeland security. And I thought of it as a way to homegrow homeland security. Sustainable resiliency becomes a way of financing and consumer behavior when you take all of the measures of public health and environment, some of the things we were talking about before that generate political drive, and you lay them on top of each other.
Mm-hmm.
And so spatial technologies are obviously used to put the performance benchmarks where they best belong. And sustainable resiliency is a trademark term, and it would be a regionally defining or measuring rating schema.
Hmm.
And it would allow, much like other periodic chart of data elements, lots of different kinds of measures about the same common place to be mashed together.
Well, you said trademark term. This is a term that you've trademarked?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Is from where do you derive the term? What ideas are you drawing on to come up with a new term in this area?
You know, the real sustainable resiliency seems to play in so many domains, David, that it's hard to pick just one.
Right.
Think about Standard & Poor's, Moody's, and Fitch,
mm-hmm.
and what they do for the debt markets, or Morningstar, what they do for the equity markets. Think about a way that sustainable resiliency is a maximized value for a region, and that as a region makes its policy decisions, smart growth or tax or reinvestment in traditional infrastructure or new infrastructure, it can either grow or decrease sustainable resiliency relative to another city that it competes with.
I see.
So now you've got multiple cities competing to have higher sustainable resiliency ratings, which might earn them better debt ratings, which might earn them cheaper. It'd be cheaper to operate there, because your taxes can be reduced if your debt rating is better.
Where does security fit into all of this? I mean, we only have a few minutes left, but you know, when we talk about transparency, when we talk about sustainable resiliency as you've defined it, overlaying all of this is the idea of there's some information that perhaps the public shouldn't get or doesn't want. There are two different things, of course, but let's focus on the shouldn't get. It's not terribly controversial to say that the public shouldn't have access to the location of the nuclear, the various nuclear weapons that are placed by the United States around the globe. Why? Well, A, terrorist could get to it. B, I mean, we can go down a list of horribles. Where does security, in terms of the ability of the technology to prevent the access to information, fit into the schema?
Well, you're talking to somebody who's a New Yorker, a transplanted New Yorker, who lived through an asbestos blast, trade towers being bombed twice,
right?
Okay, massive evacuations. And so the notion that we can protect cities from harm, I think, is fairly antiquated. I think self-reliance and the capacity to rebuild post-disaster, those are the things to maximize. For instance, if I were in charge of rebuilding the Gulf Coast, I would, in a place like New Orleans, I would be rewriting the building code to design buildings that can flood like Venice. I wouldn't think that I can rely on a single piece of infrastructure to prevent a flood. I'd say if I design the building to flood and be submerged, And then it is. And then all I have to do is throw away the drywall and the glass. I still have my footings, my foundations. I don't spend the 60 to 70% of building replacement cost re-siting the building.
Mm-hmm.
I have a place to start, and I go to recovery way faster.
Huh.
Well, how do you do that effectively? The same question would be, how do you restore the mangrove or the wetlands to absorb the 100-year or 500-year flood event or the man-made flood event, as well as the concrete seawalls that might crack in 30 years? All you have to do is ride the metro in D.C., and you'll see all the cracks in concrete if you want.
Right.
So, the harm from terrorists getting information has to be offset with the rational approach to how do you create a space, a livable space, that is much easier to come back from the disaster, God forbid, that a terrorist might cause.
Unfortunately, we're pretty much out of time here. And as always, when I have guests on, there's a half a dozen questions. I could just go from there, but it's an hour-long show, and at some point, people have to get on with their lives, especially as they're listening to the radio and podcasts. I do want to ask you, though, in closing, for those people that want to learn about more about what you do and learn about this area, how can they contact you, and where can they find more information?
The best way is to email me at bcahan at urbanlogic.org. And you can also find all of us non-resident fellows by Googling the Stanford Center for Internet and Society. And you'll come to the fellows page and you can click on that.
Terrific. Well, Bruce, thank you so much for being on the show today and discussing this topic. Hearsay Culture aims at a wide audience, from people that are immersed in the field to people that are not and are interested. And I think in this discussion we've been able to, I recognize, touch the tip of the iceberg, but discuss some of the issues in spatial technology. I look forward to following your work and developments in this area. And I thank you tremendously for joining me today on the show.
No, thank you, David.
I want to thank Bruce Cahan again for joining me today on Hearsay Culture. Discussing these kinds of topics that are not related to intellectual property in a direct sense, although there are clearly intellectual property issues involved in mapping generally, allows the Hearsay Culture to really be quite broad in its range. I'm in the process right now in late May, but also through the summer in booking guests into the fall. And I would encourage listeners, for anyone that has suggestions of interesting guests for the show, feel free and please do reach out to me. You can find all of the podcasts by going to hearsayculture.com, and you can also email me there at dave@hearsayculture.com, which is the email address that I use for the show. As always, you can find the show not only on hearsayculture.com, but also by going to the iTunes webpage for the Center for Internet and Society on iTunes. You can also go to the CIS webpage that Bruce was mentioning at cyberlaw.stanford.edu and find the podcast. And indeed, as events warrant, there may be other avenues where you could find the show. But any of those ways are good ways to get your hands on the podcast. For schedule and background and everything else in the show, please go to hearsayculture.com. So I want to thank Bruce for being here today and discussing these issues. I want to thank you for listening in. Please stay tuned to KZSU for more of its inventive programming. I do look forward to hearing from you. For any suggestions, feedbacks, comments, questions, that's how the show gets better, and so I encourage you to reach out to me to let me know what I'm doing well and what you think could be improved. So thanks again, have a great day, and I will talk to you again next week.